Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Aaron Newcomb joins me. We're going to talk about Hydra, a great way to reduce those huge volumes of data that you might be getting into something that's actually usable. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Newcomb, episode 285, recorded February 26th, 2014, Hydra. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEngine.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the small projects, projects you may be using every day and not know it, projects you might not have ever heard of, but now are certainly curious about it. With me this week again is Aaron Newcomb. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, nice to be here. It's only been a couple weeks. I'm glad to be back.
And you're looks like you're on the Brick House studio again?
Of course, yeah. I've got the donuts are in the kitchen. I don't know why you're not here. We could be enjoying all this free food.
Well, there is donuts in the kitchen here brought to me courtesy of one of my co-workers here at ZipRecruiter, but nothing I would touch. I now call them little death discs.
I can't eat them either.
They're so bad for me. I mean, it's not just the carb content, but apparently I'm pretty allergic to wheat now. And I don't mean just gluten-free. I mean wheat. Right. Overall, I've eaten gluten-free stuff, and it still triggers my my inflammations in my knees and legs. So
interesting.
I cannot have wheat of any kind anymore. I'm basically gone with that. I can have an occasional little thing, and then the little thing, you know, reminds me that I shouldn't have had even that much.
Right. Warning.
Because
warning.
I have that trigger, yes. Yeah. For the chat room, no, it's not just celiac disease. It's wheat actually has six other things besides gluten that are really, really bad for you. You should stay away from all modern wheat. If you can find the ancient einkorn wheat, I think it would be better, but that's pretty rare.
Right.
So
not or just whole corn. Or just eat the whole kernel, maybe.
That's brought to you by This Week in Nutrition, the show I want to do. But no, this show is not about nutrition. This show is, in fact, about open source software. We have, like always, we have a really great project on this week. Let me get my notes here, pull over. It's the Hydra project. Chris Burrows is going to join us in a few minutes to talk about Hydra. And Hydra, as I can understand it from the only hour that I get to scan these things before the show, is a way of doing large data processing in nearly real time. So you have some sort of incoming stream of data, and maybe it's just a flat text file, or maybe it's like real-time information coming from web logs or something like that. And then you go through a distributed processing system. And maybe, you know, stored in Hadoop or whatever, but you go through some sort of distributed processing system, and you can get outputs of real-time analytics from this data, do data reduction on it, summarization, windowing, things like that. So it looks pretty interesting. Is that what you see from this so far, Aaron?
Yeah, it looks pretty interesting. I mean, you know, I've worked with document processing systems for a long time. And so I'm kind of interesting to see where this fits in from a data perspective. Is this is this going to compete with something like Hadoop, or is it going to really just organize all your files and things that you've got floating around and make them more accessible and easier to search through? So it'll be really interesting to see how this actually works.
Yeah, well, let's not stop talking idly about it. Let's go ahead and bring on somebody who really knows the answers. Chris Burrows, welcome to the show.
Oh, welcome. Nice to be here.
Thank you. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking to you from Washington, D.C., where it appears to just stop snowing.
Wow. We've had some record snows this year. Well, you guys have. I've actually been in sunny Southern California most of this. But are you still digging out from the previous one? And so it's the current one?
A bit. Well, I grew up in New England, so this is actually kind of nice for me.
Oh, okay. Well, so you're a little better off than some of the other places I've heard evil stories about already. Cool. I actually was in New York City coming back on the Queen Mary 2 on January 3rd, I think it was, and it just started a giant snowstorm, and we just barely got out of there from the airport before they closed everything down. So I can relate. I can relate stomping through foot-deep snow, which is probably small for some of the areas there. They're saying, well, only a foot? You're a wimp. Anyway, so we didn't call – this isn't This Week in Weather. This is actually This Week in Floss Weekly. So let's talk about Hydra. What – can you give us the 30,000-foot view?
Sure. So I think the 40,000 view you started with is pretty accurate. It's a distributed processing system. It can run jobs or tasks of various sorts. And usually those jobs and tasks ingest log files. and either spit out some sort of post-process log file or some index tree that summarizes and aggregates the data, so you can say how many, if it was a like web Apache log type things, how many views of this URL were there over this time period, or how many unique IP addresses requested this resource, things of that nature.
So how did Hydra get started? What was the problem that was being solved?
Cool. So we had a previous suite of products that were little online web widgets. So you had like a little Flash widget on your site, and you could like share that widget, and it would show up in someone else's blog or site or whatever. Might be used for something like NBA player cards or something like that. And that was, we were a small startup, so we had sort of thrown everything together with whatever worked. And part of what worked for a while was like one SQL database somewhere that had like a PHP API talking to it. And sort of the story or legend goes that one day back in 2006 or so, database started getting a lot slower, and more or less broke Friday night, and our people sort of went off for the weekend and sort of threw together a custom Java solution to support what we were doing at the time, and that was what was running Monday morning.
Wow! I mean, this is a more sophisticated version of the old page hit counters that I used to put on my website.
So this old product, it would, instead of, say, just a page hit counter, it would be more a widget with maybe like a feed of your blog or a recent podcast or something like that. And then it would have some integrated sharing functionality that people could use to share that onto their blog or feeds and things like that. And the sort of interesting thing there was that each widget had a unique ID, and there were lots of them, as there was both a unique ID for each widget and each placement of the widget. And that those tuples quickly multiplied together to be relatively large numbers.
Now, the first thing I thought when I started reading through the documentation for this is that this is similar to Hive. My previous client was basically playing with Hive to do some data analytics of their voluminous amount of data for their hits during a day, 20 million hits a day, or no, 2 billion hits a day. So that's a significant number of data reductions to do. Now, but it's not quite like Hive, is it? It's something more real-time-ish to it, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think the biggest similarity with Hive is that usually, and I should preface this with saying, like, I've used Hadoop. We have some like proof of concept Hadoop clusters we've played with and done various things. You can write Hadoop files from Hydra, but I'm not an expert by any means. But anyway, so with Hive, you tend to have like a bunch of files, and you've written these various queries and UDFs and whatnot to sort of give you a view into that data. The data analysts can then go and answer all of the interesting questions that they have. Where I think Hydra would differ is it can do those things too. It can build a bunch of, as I said, like trees that index and summarize the data. But I think it would be relatively unusual for like a website with like an analytics console to like be making queries directly to Hive and expecting responses in a reasonable amount of time. But that's the sort of typical canonical use case for Hydra.
Yeah, the Hive thing seems to always have a constant time, no matter how complex the query was. It was always like at least 18 seconds, and then it would come back. And I was like, well, now we know, no matter how complex the question is, it's 18 seconds or whatever. I imagine that changed depending on the size of the data. Hive looks to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, it looks more like you have some sort of input coming from somewhere, and that can be all sorts of different sources. Then you're setting up effectively a series of formulas, a series of data reductions. So like, I want to cluster this by where the web hit came from, or I want to cluster this by time of day, broken down by the hour or whatever. And then some way to then get that into data output somewhere, like maybe for your real-time console or maybe these little widgets you're talking about. Is that sort of what's going on?
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair summary that there's, tends to be a pipeline, and that pipeline has a bunch of things that are, transformations, reverse a string, whatever, sort of all the nitty-gritty things you have to do to deal with dirty real data. But then at the end of the day, you get an index thing that you can go to say, hey, give me all the things by this, by that, by this other thing. And there's a trade-off there. You have to sort of think of what things you want ahead of time. If you wanted, if you want to be able to get, hit counts for every URL in your web logs, you have to decide in your Hydra job that you want to store counts for each URL. You can't just sort of aggregate it together by virtual host or domain or something like that. So there is a little trade-off there that if you want decide you want some sort of new thing, you have to sort of, you know, tweak your job and do a new pass over the data, and then sort of drop your new replacement job in with the latest and greatest analysis.
So just like any of these systems, Hive, Hadoop, which work together, Hydra, I mean, you kind of have to know, it's kind of garbage in, garbage out, right? I mean, you kind of have to know what you've got and set up your jobs correctly before you can actually go in and start mining the data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's definitely the case. And I think there's definitely there's a professor of computer science from University of Maryland who like wrote a book about Hadoop and did a long sabbatical at Twitter. And he's given a number of sort of talks about his experiences. And there's all sorts of interesting things about sort of custom, very intricate Hadoop job construction and things like that to get the answers you want. But so much of the work is in sort of dealing with like real data on the web is sort of cleaning that data up and processing it and understanding what you actually have and deciding on like sort of schemas, for lack of a better word, ahead of time so that you've decided if you're going to have, you know, UID or some other key be all uppercase or camel case or lowercase or whatever. Because if all of those sort of complications aren't dealt with relatively quickly, then you're sort of, nice smart data analysis. You're trying to make, you know, maybe derive some business insights for your data or something. You're going to have just way too much incidental complexity to deal with. So all of that. That data cleanup, I think, is sort of common to anyone with data on the web and is very important.
Yeah, and there is, I mean, it used to be more, storage is becoming cheaper, which is good. I mean, it used to be that you couldn't afford to keep all that data. So a lot of it would have to be thrown away. It was just like, well, we'll keep the most important bits and we'll throw away everything we don't need. And now with, analytics becoming more and more important, and the rise of things like Hadoop, it's like, well, let's just go put this out on some cheap storage because you'll never know if you're going to need it. Is there a balance now? It sounds like from what you're saying there is, but is there a balance now between, hey, keep what you need, but don't go crazy because you're just going to end up with piles and piles of data that that isn't going to be used? Or is the trend more towards, no, keep everything, keep it stored, put it into this system, and eventually we'll get to it?
So what we usually do for any sort of incoming stream of data is that we'll keep some rolling number of days, a month, 90 days, whatever is appropriate for that data stream. I think where the trade-off comes is that initially what we do is like, yeah, this is great. We have this stream of data, and then Chris is going to like create his thing that pre-processes the data and outputs like, you know, these fields you need, and then someone else is going to do the same thing. So we have this one incoming stream of data, and now we have sort of like 20 intermediary streams of data. And then we have like a bunch of different Hydra jobs that are looking at all those 20 different streams of data and coming up with like slightly different answers. So I think definitely with storage becoming cheaper, it's still reasonable and will continue to become even more reasonable to keep long periods of relatively raw data. But that as sort of a matter of company discipline, it's very important to do whatever standardization or cleanup you want to do first and early and not have a bunch of variations propagate forever.
Right. Now, I know that Hive has their own language, a query language that they use, which I guess is similar to SQL or at least in structure. Mm-hmm. Do you guys offer that as well? I know you have APIs, but do you offer you wouldn't call them a DBA at that point, but for the analytics specialist, let's say, do you have a language or a way to interface with Hydra that they can easily pick up and start writing queries?
Sure. So there's sort of two different mini languages in Hydra. One is sort of the language for describing jobs, either jobs that are ingesting log files and spitting out log files, or doing these sort of trees and indexes and aggregations I've been talking about. And that's a JSON-based DSL. So when you're describing what index or tree you want, you say, hey, I want this thing at the top and this thing at the bottom, and then I want maybe these five different things at this level. And that that's a JSON DSL. It's relatively straightforward to at least read. You know, obviously there's a lot of like domain specific knowledge people need, but that's what people actually use to write Hydra jobs. And when they've written up their little JSON config file, that there's a web interface they go to, and they sort of paste it in. Decide, hey, I want this to run on so many nodes, or this is a special job, so it needs so much memory, or whatever. And then they kick go, and it goes off and runs. And usually, it'll be set to go over the past week of data or something, and then every hour run again and go over all the new data since the last time you ran. There's also a query language that's used for actually querying that data, and that is a very, very terse thing. It's not based on JSON or anything like that. But you would say something like using like forward slashes to navigate like through a URL. Say give me, if you had some job that was doing IP addresses per Apache virtual host or whatever, you might say virtual host name slash IP star and get all the IP addresses, and then you can do that effectively is streaming you a table back to borrow a little bit of terminology, and then there's a bunch of operations you can apply to that to collapse columns together, or sort of group by or merge some, add a title to the column, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Is that the primary difference, the tree hierarchy? Is that the primary difference between something like Hydra and something like Hive? Is this, instead of a table structure, it's more of a tree structure?
Yeah, I would say that the intermediary tree that's used to sort of store an index of data is the most most unusual part, right? Like it's cool that Hydra has a job execution engine, and it's cool that it has this little terse query engine, but I think it's that, and it's cool that ingest log files and spit out new log files. But I think it's that middle step with those trees that's the most most interesting and most a characteristic part.
Yeah, because that's what I noticed right off the bat was that it was a tree structure. And I was like, oh, really? That's a little bit different than the way most people do it. Before we get into some more technical questions that I have, can you tell us who's using Hydra? And if you can't mention names, that's fine. But, how are they using it? So what are they? I mean, you gave one use case, which was log files and data about servers and things. I mean, how are other people using this? Can you give us some examples just to get our mindset around this thing?
Sure. So, Hydra was written by Addis, who I'm an engineer, and it's sort of the data processing tool of choice. So if there's any graph at Addis, and it's not like a server load average generated by RD tool, it's probably generated by Hydra. The Addis makes a tool of tools you can put on your website to help encourage people to engage with your content and share it to various services and things like that. And that tool suite's viewed about 3 billion times a day across about 14 million domains. So that's sort of our bread and butter bulk of data that comes in. You as a sort of publisher with a website can go to addis.com and get all sorts of stats about how many shares were there in this country with a service or over this time range, or what are sort of the people on my site interested in, or what are they... For the people on my site who share, do they have different interests than people who just sort of view my site and bounce off? Addis then has also like a bunch of all of our sort of like backend processes, everything from sort of URL scraping to classification to building audiences for advertisers is all things that we do on top of Hydra. There's also sort of integration points for reading from Apache Kafka, which is like a log queuing system. Or in addition to sort of feeding data out into sort of the built-in Hydra things, we can also feed data into Apache Cassandra or HDFS. I think it's pretty common for an open source project that came out of a company that's been working on it for a while. It was sort of the first earliest adopters to be people who are already familiar with it for some reason, former employees and whatnot. So Stuart Allen, who was Addis's former CTO, was off with various new ventures and projects, and he's prototyping Hydra for various things there. There was a Wired article recently about that, if you want to look that up. But they're all sort of like early stage prototypes, which are interesting and exciting, but not have not been released to the world yet. There have also been, there was this one gentleman who came and made like a slide deck all about Hydra and posted it online, and I don't know who this person is. They just kind of came out of the blue and wrote a little slide deck about Hydra, and that was really cool, but I don't know what he's up to. I hope it's something cool that he shares.
That's always nice when you're, and it happens a lot with open source, where someone comes and picks up your project and starts doing something with it, and out of the blue, and all of a sudden you get this note, hey, I created this awesome thing, I thought you might be interested, and you're like, holy crap, that's awesome. Which is always great. Now, how long is the project? We're going to get into some more open source questions in a minute, but just in terms of history, how long has it been open source, and how was that decision made?
So it's been open source since the beginning of this year, in very early January. And we came to that decision. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, thought about it. We had, discussions and back and forth. But add this, is built on open source. Hydra is built on open source. So it was just sort of obviously the right thing to do. And we just eventually came around to saying, since this is the right thing to do, we should go ahead and do it and stop waiting.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's get into a couple infrastructure questions before I let Randall jump back in. So how easy is this to set up? Is it something, how long is it going to take me? What kind of hardware do I need? Is it, memory intensive or storage intensive or CPU intensive? Give me an idea for how easy it is or how hard it is to set up and what kind of resources I need to get it going.
Sure. There's a bunch of different, components about Hydra where there's like a, local menu that runs the jobs, and there is like a sort of master node, things like that. For sort of purposes of local development, and if you just want to mess around with it, you can run all of those on your laptop. There's like a if you go to the repository, there's a local stack script. So you would do Maven, some Java Maven project to build the thing and end up with a bunch of jars, and then you would run this local stack, and you would get the nice little web UI would pop up. And then there's a sample job, or it should be a sample job or two. You can plug in and get some at least example results. We did have one sort of amusing use case a while ago where there was a vendor we were trying to understand how exactly we were being billed better, and they ended up sending us like a 100 megabyte Excel spreadsheet, and we actually treated that as one giant log file to send through Hydra and try to summarize and figure out what was actually going on. So it can be used for small data as well, although that's certainly not the typical use case. Mm-hmm. Runs most of our stuff. Most of our processes are on dedicated hardware with Hydra clusters, ranging up through the area of around 150 nodes. But certainly clusters of, a laptop to a dozen nodes are reasonable and viable. It sort of depends on how much data you have. It's not Hydra doesn't have so much like a minimum cluster size.
Right. And what are you bottlenecked on typically? And you just speak from whatever you're doing with it. I mean, is it I/O bound typically, or does it tend to be more processing intensive?
Well, the truthful answer, of course, is it depends. We often try to just keep applying more compression until it's CPU bound, just because CPU bound problems are somewhat easier to reason about. But in practice, when something gets hard, it's usually getting hard because it's I/O bound, because there's all these nice indexes I've been talking about. Eventually, they stop fitting in memory, and if your index doesn't fit in memory, then no amount of magic is going to make things fast on spinny disks.
Right, right, yeah, and that's what we find that. I mean, it's typically a database problem as well, is especially as computer systems have gotten faster. CPUs have been following Moore's law. Memory has too, for the most part, but then. For the longest time, we were bound by spinning disk, and so databases became really I/O bound for a while. But now that's changing a little bit too with flash memory and things. So, how large of a data set do you think this will scale to? So, we talked the fact that you can start on a laptop and add some dedicated servers, but mm-hmm. what's your opinion? Is it an infinite amount, or is there an upper limit of how much data you can pump into this?
Sure. So we use Zookeeper for sort of the typical things you use Zookeeper for, group membership, a little bit of configuration, things like that. I'm sure there's some upper limit to the scalability of Zookeeper, but that I think we're hopeful that we're well below that. And like I said, we have our largest clusters are in the order of, say, 150 nodes. And I think anything up to, I'm sure there are some things that it would be interesting that will happen if we scaled something up to 256 or 500 or 1,000 nodes. But up to that level, I don't see any sort of like fundamental problems. And beyond that, I suspect more exciting things would happen, but we haven't spent too much time thinking about that.
Right, right. Were you guys at Strata? Wasn't Strata just recently here in Santa Clara, I think, or San Francisco, right?
I believe we had an engineer too at Strata New York, the New York edition, but I'm not sure anyone made it out to San Francisco.
Yeah, so Strata, for people that don't know, is kind of like the data mining or data analysis kind of Hadoop, all things analytics conference, right? They do a lot of that, and so I figured this would fit right in there. So we talked about size. What, as far as the structure of how the nodes, is there like a name node? Is there some sort of a upper level node that then disperses the load across all of the nodes underneath?
Sure. So each worker node or minion has a daemon whose job is to effectively run the jobs it's told to run. There's a process that sort of serves up files, and there's a process that answers queries of these index trees. There is sort of a set of master nodes, and they run sort of the master job execution engine whose job is to go tell those minions, hey, you should go run this job now. There's a query master node that's the starting point for the scatter-gather query system. Where it'll go, if you have some query against this job, it'll go figure out, hey, these nodes have the data for this job, and then go ask them and merge the results together. And then there's also the zookeeper quorum usually is co-located with those nodes, but that's not a particular necessary point. We've also been exploring storing some of the sort of job configuration data in Cassandra. That's sort of like an ongoing experiment, because shoving too much stuff into Zookeeper is not what Zookeeper is good at. And there's also for sort of that command and control, hey, you guy, go run this job, or tell me you finished this job, RabbitMQ is used as the sort of command and control queuing system.
No, I'm sort of curious now. You said this scales all the way back down to, say, using it just on my laptop. And I presume that if some of our audience wants to play with this, this is sort of where they're going to start. What am I looking at when I've installed this? Is this all command line stuff and editing files, and then more command line stuff gets spit out? Or, or is there some web interface? How do I interact with this in the smallest version of it?
Sure. So if you start up the local stack, the last instruction would be like, go point your browser at this address, and then you'll get like a web interface. And that web interface will have, you know, all sorts of numbers across the top, because you know, every metric we thought interesting, we've added there about how many nodes are in the cluster and how many are currently running a task and how much the space is there, et cetera. And then you'll have a nice big list of jobs. It'll be empty to start with. And then there's sort of an integrated job editor where if you start typing up one of these JSON DSL jobs, you'll get like syntax highlighting and various nice things like that. Mm. You can then go hit run, and you can, you know, see it'll, you know, say, hey, this job is running, and you can tail the sort of integrated thing into web UI for tailing the log files and sort of useful debugging things like that. And then there's a big fat query button that'll open up a query browser. And you can either sort of click around your job, or if you sort of already know what you want, you can sort of type in the query you want to run. I would say that's the most typical way to use Hydra, sort of as part of the integrated stack. You can also sort of use it as like an expert version where you're trying to compete with sed and awk and things like that, and use it from the command line and, you know, ingest maybe, you know, 100 megabyte Excel file or something crazy and spit out some CSV file or the answers to various pre-computed queries. But the pretty web UI is the typical way to go.
So would that be enough of a setup for me, say, to watch, say, on my laptop, I have an Apache web server that is serving, I don't know, only the few requests that I'm actually hitting of my own, I guess, not out to the world. But how does it keep getting new data? Is there some way to, say, watch this file and keep sucking from it?
Yeah, so you can say there's a few different ways you can sort of track files that have been processed. Usually you say, hey, I want to read files from this directory, either like a local directory, one served by that little mesh file serving process that I said recently. Mm-hmm. And there's a Mark database that keeps track of, hey, I've seen this file, and it had a last modified time of such and such, and it had this many bytes in it, and I've read up to this many of the bytes. And then when the job runs a second or third time, it goes and looks at all the files and says, okay, I've read all the bytes in this file, so I don't have to do anything with it, but this file is new, so I should read all of it, or this file is bigger than it was last time, so I should start where I left off.
That's pretty awesome. And so just not, you can be kind of naive about that. Can that collector process be running on a remote system and then feed into this somehow?
So sometimes we have like a, you know, big industrial grade, you know, data streaming system backed by Apache Kafka or whatnot. Sometimes there's a type of Hydra job that just like rsyncs in a bunch of data. And then you have sort of your raw log files from Apache or whatnot. That you you can go run your job on. You would say, job ID / whatever directory structure you created for your Apache logs and go run with it. To your question about can you just like download it and run it, the short answer is yes. But one thing we're very aware of is that there's some documentation, which is great, but we definitely need more examples. For example, there should be an example for sort of like the canonical parsing an Apache log file hydro job. Right now, all the examples are sort of more mundane synthetic things, and that's something we'd really like to improve. There's a project, I think, from Ted Dunning that's designed to generate sort of log files where you can sort of specify, you know, it has this many columns, and you can set, you know, enclose it in brackets or whatever funny things Apache does, and then spit out things that actually look like IP addresses and URLs and whatnot. So you, it's easy to have sort of generate synthetic data to run jobs for and sort of demonstrate how they work without just saying, you know, this is the foo in the bar and it counts the baz or whatever, which is less easy to grasp.
So, and a question inspired by our real-time chat room, Espresso Shot asks a question. Well, I'll rephrase it for him. Is it you've set up the cluster, so you own everything in the cluster, or is there multi-user accessible channels here? Can I have jobs and you have jobs both in the same cluster using the same sources, but maybe having different indexes for output?
Sure. So each job gets a UUID, there would be a unique UID both for like sort of the import source jobs or like import sources or maybe intermediary jobs or there's sort of like final indexing ones we were talking about. So there can be multiple jobs that read from the same input or multiple jobs that read from the same input and then makes like new intermediaries that are sort of used by themselves. Each job is unique though, so you can't clobber each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's currently, you can sort of like specify your username when you're in that web UI, but that's at this point, it's mostly for sort of convenience. There's not sort of like fancy resource controls or ACLs around that.
Okay, so it's just for noting that somebody by this name.
Yeah, so if someone is malicious, they can probably do something mean to you, but for everyday occurrences, we've never had a problem where someone's gone and like clobbered someone else's job or something like that, because everyone gets their own unique sandbox.
So it's a shared environment, but we have a chalkboard that we can sign up. Boy, chalkboard! I'm dating myself. Whiteboard. I hate that when I do this. Oh man, they let anybody do this show? It's obvious. No, so you have a whiteboard that you can write. Okay, I'm doing these jobs over here. Yes.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, and the outputs, you said I can just turn it back into a flat file, but you talked also about doing like, you know, a real-time, you know, war room analytics kind of thing. How do you get it into a system like that, and what kind of interfaces are available to you for that?
Sure, so as I mentioned before, like on the various daemons that are running, one of them is this query daemon I glossed over. And so that query daemon is there, and it's looking at all the jobs, and the jobs have some typing information. And if it's a queryable job, which means instead of spitting out log files, we spit out this hydro tree, then it knows, hey, I have this large set of jobs that have queryable data, and if someone asks me for them, I should respond in kind. That query master node knows, you know, which jobs are where, so it knows who to ask if I get a query for this job. And then there's a web UI for actually making those, with a UI and an API for actually making those queries. So you might say, if we had some sample log that's, or sort of sample job that's summarizing, you know, which URLs were popular for this vhost or this IP or this website, things like that, you would sort of express that as a query where you would say, you know, give me all the URLs for this vhost, and merge the accounts together and sort them. And that would be one query you would send to the system, and then you would get back a CSV or whatever sort of JSON format you wanted with the answer. And so if you had some like, you know, PHP web app or whatever, you would probably want JSON, and it could suck those in and make a graph for you.
Okay, and so I understand also that people have like real-time data displays. I think the tool's called Graphite that allows you to display things like, can you take this data and also have it feed Graphite so I can put it alongside all my other quantizations?
Sure. Hydra emits various metrics that are intended to go to ganglia or graphite or systems like that. In principle, if you wanted your job to output its data, not just sort of its data about how it's running to graphite, you could do that. We don't have a system for that yet. For sort of like real timiness of data, usually, as I said, jobs will kick on some frequency and look to see if they have new data. And sometimes that frequency is, I don't know, they'll kick once a day or once every few hours, but they could also kick, you know, every 5 minutes or 1 minute. We also have, the real time, with regards to the web, is sort of an overused term, but things that update every 5 minutes, so certainly much faster than the old waiting for your daily update that you have with Google Analytics or whatnot. There's also support that's almost but not quite there for instead of querying these sort of the last run of the job, query the job as it's running and use that. So you get the latest and greatest up to the second or whatnot.
Cool. And so the let's talk a little bit more about the software itself now. You mentioned Maven. I'm presuming that means this is all in Java?
Yep. One big Java project broken into multiple Maven modules. It's almost all vanilla Java. There's a few places where Scala and whatnot sneaks in to integrate with some Scala system. It's primarily written in Java. It uses Maven to build bash scripts to execute draw files.
And how was Java chosen as the language of choice for implementation?
At the time, the languages we were using were mostly PHP and Java. And between those two, Java was sort of the obvious choice. The engineers at the time were using Java, so that's what they used, and they ran with it.
And given this just became open source, a month and a half ago, what kind of participation have you had from the open source community about this, and what's the reaction been to that?
Well, cool. So we've had a bunch of sort of like retweets and interest and things like that, which is gratifying. Some of the former CTO I mentioned has been sending many pull requests with that sort of project going. We haven't had I mentioned we had some like people like writing slide decks or something about Hydra, which was a total surprise. We haven't had a patch that sort of came out of the blue yet, but we're looking forward to it.
And in an ongoing way, then, do you imagine that AdThis is going to still control the governance of this project, or do you think that eventually you'll be turning it over to key contributors in the open source side of the community?
I would love to have that problem. I think is my answer. that would be a wonderful problem to have. I'm sure there'd be maybe a few possibly heated email threads, but that would just be so wonderful and gratifying to see that. I would look forward to it.
And what's the upstream of this? I mean, are you using other people's projects to help with some of the data reduction? Well, you said Zookeeper, right? So that's probably one piece of it.
Yeah, sure. So sort of like system dependency-wise, there's RabbitMQ and Apache Zookeeper, and then Kafka and Cassandra are sort of at the periphery for various jobs. There's also a very interesting copy-on-write LD preload library that someone used because they didn't want to like keep too many copies of the Linux kernel around. It has a very, very 1990s style website, but we actually use that to make copy-on-write copies of the jobs and incremental backups, and that's very handy. As is probably typical of most Maven projects, there's many, many dozens of other jars we pull in and use for all sorts of things. The query system and that file stream I mentioned is built on top of Netty, for example.
Well, I presume also prior to this being an open source project, you had a number of internal engineers at your company working on this and probably had a roadmap of things that are still missing. Did that become the public roadmap as you made this open source?
Sure. So we've started to try to give some sort of like, I guess, guidance about what people are working on at AdThis. Most of it, or at least I think the initial things are sort of stability, fix bugs, make it easier to use, things like that, and things that are relatively obvious. It has that long set of dependencies, and some of those dependencies are old, why not have a new release and get everything up to the latest and greatest, so it's easier to reason about. People have sort of, I guess one of the things we've struggled with is that sort of like the flow of code, because it's really easy where you control all of your repositories and you can just like sort of make releases whenever because you wanted to tag it because that was convenient for what like one engineer happened to be doing at a time. And something we've struggled with is how to have sort of that, how the sort of flow of code and tagging and releases and what releases mean should work now that it's an open source project.
Yeah, it's always a little bit of a struggle once you have to change some of your processes like that. Is your bug tracker and therefore future things that are interesting is that public now?
So it's on. So we've used GitHub for for all of the products we've open sourced, and the issues there are real issues. They're issues we're tracking and trying to fix. We've historically, way back in the day, we would generate like huge lists of bugs that were sort of to-do ideas, and then periodically declare bankruptcy and sort of sweep them all away. So something we're trying to think about is how can we get better about that and having a better long-term roadmap, because that's something we tended not to have internally, because what Hydra did was always very much driven. And what we worked on with Hydra was always what do we need to support our business, and not sort of cool things to do for engineering to say.
And is this a complete set of software, or it mostly like everything you were already using internally, or is this like just the core pieces and you're still going to have to do a lot of glue to make it work in your system?
I would say it is, it's the core pieces and most of the batteries, although not all. There are a few things that sort of aren't there because they're just integration with internal things. Like we have like an internal advertising rules engine we use to run that part of the business, and that's sort of stereotypically, you know, proprietary secret sauce. There's no point in like releasing the shim to integrate with that. There are some things that integrate with Kafka, as I mentioned, that are sort of stuck on like a Kafka like 0.7.0 like original release, and we're not quite sure how to move that forward. And there's also a similar case for the outputting job data to Cassandra. We're not quite sure. That's also sort of like stuck on some old version of some Cassandra client library. We're not quite sure how to move that forward. And there's also integration with sort of other parts of like the AdThis infrastructure stack around monitoring and alerting and who to send the right emails to, and stuff like that. That doesn't and sort of or like sort of multi-cluster management across multiple data centers. It's all sort of tied into our infrastructure. It's not part of the open source suite. Because we don't think, and, you know, either because it's sort of old or crufty or doesn't, or is very specific to us. Like, you know, probably have your own, you know, favorite monitoring or alerting solution that you want to run with. You don't want to use some different thing just because you're using Hydra.
And what is the business motivation for making this open source? Are you expecting the community to help make things better, faster, and cheaper? Or are you eventually going to have like a freemium model of this to help fund its development? Or you just like to make things open source?
So we had previously re-released a small little library called Streamlib that had a bunch of probabilistic data structures in it. So that's stuff like Bloom filters, which are a way to say, probabilistically say, is something a member of a set? And also various cool tools for cardinality estimation, which is estimating how many things are in the set without storing all of the members. So for example, if you wanted to count IP addresses, you probably wouldn't want to make a set with 4 billion numbers in it because that would take a great deal of memory. So mathematicians have done all sorts of great work so that you can, you know, in some reasonable number of kilobytes, express the same thing with some small error bounds. And that library got, you know, as obviously a very niche set of interests in sort of like the network analytics and online advertising space, but got some very real and meaty and interesting contributions from the community, and we didn't really promote it in any way besides like a few blog posts. And that was really cool to see, and that was sort of something we took to heart when we decided to open source Hydra. So if we see you know, see sort of adoption and community around that, that would be great. That would be, you know, super exciting for all of the engineers who worked on it. Also part of the you know, open sourcing it was that we can talk about it more. We've tried to sort of like talk about what we're doing at conferences and whatnot, but it's a lot harder if you can't say like, hey, this is the URL for you can, you know, download and run the thing I'm talking about. It is much easier to talk about what you're doing. You can do that, and as a sort of a company that's in the web, or for lack of a better term, big data space, we'd like to be able to talk about what we're doing. You know, not just say that we have some cool secret sauce, but show, hey, here's the open source software we wrote, and you can go run it too.
I had a couple more questions just listening to you guys talk. The first one is about types of data. Is there? I mean, I know it's early days, but do you feel like there's a type of data? And I know you use log files a lot in your examples, but maybe that's because they're just easier to grasp the concept for administrators. Mm-hmm. But is there a type of data that you think works better for Hydra, or that people will probably use Hydra for? Or do you think it's just good for all types of data? Or the opposite would be, is there a type of data that you would not want to use Hydra for?
Sure. So any sort of data that is sort of a streaming timestamp series of events, I think, is a very natural fit for Hydra. And sort of that can be either sort of like application logs, as I gave a bunch of examples for, or larger web properties. Usually, jcreps has like from LinkedIn, has like a very long book almost. He posted about like the log and how that's sort of central to a modern enterprise. But sort of the series of all events that's happening. And you can, you know, if you wanted to kind of operations, you know, research nerd out, you can even think of that on like a factory floor, like where are all the parts and where are they moving to and who's doing what work. But either way, for an enterprise or a business, there's like a log of events and anything that fits that time series, you know, this happened then, and you know, XYZ feel, I think is a relatively natural fit for Hydra. You can use it for arbitrary awk sed grep slicing and dicing, but that's, I mean, people are, you know, awk is already there and it's great, so I don't think it'll, you know, that's necessarily the best use case. We've sort of extended it to things that don't quite fit that role quite as well. For example, we do scrape URLs so that we can then go and do some content classification on them. And we run that as a Hydra job where like one of the fields in the log file is like the entire HTML of the page. And that works and it fits, but it's not the most natural thing. And I think other things where you say you had you know, some large corpus of like some static text documents from open government thing or whatnot might not necessarily be the most natural fit.
Yeah. I know I was at a talk done down at Google a couple weeks ago, and Robert Scoble was there, and he has a new book. And so he was kind of talking about what he talks about in the book. But there's a lot of data that's coming out of sensors. And it just strikes me that this may be a good fit depending on what what form the data takes that comes out of those sensors. But, you know, you mentioned factory, you know, equipment, you know, things are getting smarter and they're able to output things that they weren't able to output before. Not only, you know, did the job pass or did the job fail? You know, did we make the Coke bottle or did we not make the Coke bottle? I mean, that's interesting. But then they're also able to say, hey, we made this Coke bottle, but I noticed that this particular bottle was, you know, 2 millimeters or two, you know, even smaller, whatever, you know, off the standard, as I was printing the label on the bottle or something like that. You know, I mean, so you can get all kinds of much more data, and we can support more data now that the pipes are bigger to everything. So I'm just kind of curious, in terms of, you know, the Internet of Things and having inputs come in from a lot of different sensors all over the place, do you think that is going to play into Hydra's future?
So the examples I gave were all sort of web event-centric, but I don't, and maybe there's already some built-in filters for parsing URLs or whatever, but beyond that, I don't think there's anything special about, you know, website data that's different from other event streams. If you want to parse, had your data from the factory floor, and you wanted to sort of do your distribution of are your labels in the right place, or one of my sort of like hackathon projects I hope to get to is like parsing like, I don't know, StarCraft II replay logs with Hydra, and you know, see, you know, did you build enough pylons or whatever. Ooh. I think all of those are very reasonable things as you look at this sort of things emitting events on the internet besides just sort of the traditional like user agents going to websites.
Right. And then one other question, and maybe I missed this as I was looking up things as you were talking, but where did the name Hydra come from?
So I think it was the distributed system, and there's sort of that multiple heads is what the Greek Hydra has, and that was where the name came from. I'm not sure if there's more of a story to it than that, honestly.
Hmm. Yeah, I thought there was probably a tie-in there. I was thinking of the same thing, the water aspect, and then I was thinking, oh, there's a fire hydrant maybe, you know, open the fire hydrant, there comes the data, or something like that.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot of good, sort of distributed system and resiliency-based things that you could do about, you know, Hydra, and you cut off one head, now there's two, and that, you know, sounds like a great thing for a distributed system. Although, honestly, when Hydra was named, it was, you know, we had just written this custom Java thing, so it was not the most stable thing in the world, unfortunately. It's improved a lot since then. Maybe it's more, the name fits better now.
I got a question that's a little more direct about you. How did you get selected, or how did you volunteer, or whatever it was, to actually bring this thing open source?
So I've been working on like a bunch of different things at this, everything from like quality assurance to sort of back-end Java development, which meant Hydra a lot, to sort of the traditional sort of like systems administrator operations type things. And we were sort of talking about what we want to do for the rest of the day, or rest of the year, rather.
The rest of the day.
Sorry. Yeah, no, it was a much larger project than that. But we were going into the fourth quarter of last year and said, hey, we had sort of thrown this thing down about how it'd be kind of cool if we open sourced some stuff this year. We haven't really made any progress. If it's going to happen, we should do it now. And that was how I ended up volunteering myself for that project.
And what has been the most difficult part of it for other people that are probably going through similar things in their companies listening to this?
In our case, I think the most difficult part was we're just sort of wrapping our heads around like what we had done over like half a decade, and trying to figure out how should we open source, in which parts moduled how, because it is inevitable for any large software project to get a bunch of cruft, as I said, right? So it's convenient to have one big repo that has like all of our custom integrations with like other things we do at Abyss. So I think the hardest part was just sitting down and figuring out, this is what we want at the end, and this is what we should look at, and this is how the best way for the code to be divided up, and then sort of dividing and conquering from there. Because once you can say, okay, here's the thing we're going to break out as some little like Java utility collections library, then that's a very tractable problem. But if you're just looking at like 100,000 lines of code and being like, where do I start? And you spin your wheels.
Mm. And since you put this on Git, or GitHub, so how much of the history did you include? Did you include the history all the way back to the beginning of the project, or did you carefully cut it off like as of a month ago?
No, it's a new birth, starting a new epoch. That would be a bit of advice. Like, I think that's unless from the very beginning you've intended something to be an open source project and maintain that discipline even when it's internal. I think making that clean break is the right thing to do, because it's hard enough to open source 80 or 100,000 line project. It's way harder to do 80,000. You effectively have a unique project for every commit if you want to try to keep all of the history, and that just becomes a very 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 large project.
Yeah, I can easily imagine that you would have perhaps commits that would refer to internal facets of your operations, and you wouldn't want those commit messages to leak out into the public.
Exactly. Yeah, we thought about doing something like where we like rewrote every Git commit to be like something new, but that would be like thousands of Git commits to rewrite and not particularly useful. It's something we've intended to do but haven't done yet, and I think it's a very good thing to do, though, is have a changelog and have that changelog include some of the things that happened before that. Time zero open source, so that people sort of have some way of understanding like where things came from or why they are a certain way.
And so as you move forward now, is the code base that's out on GitHub the same code base you're using live, or do you still have a parallel internal one?
So we have an internal like wrapper that sort of includes the various special integrations, with alerting and monitoring and rules engines and stuff like that, but there's not like a secret address fork where the development happens first. The master branch on GitHub is the real master branch.
And so do you have your engineers now actually committing to that in public?
Yep. Yeah. They either commit directly to it, or we're trying to do more review and then commit, because that's good both for us and good for an open source project.
And are you using GitHub's like pull request mechanism for that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we're currently doing, and it seems to be working out pretty well so far. So that's something we didn't do enough of internally, and it's sort of a nice side benefit that it's more natural and obvious to do now that it's open source. So we're just going to do it.
Cool. I had like four questions, and all of a sudden, all four of them. We're almost out of time, which is one of the questions I have to ask. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you want to make sure our audience is aware of?
I think we've hit it. Hydra is there, and if you have a big data problem or a gnarly spreadsheet, it's there for you to use, and we'd love to hear about it.
Oh, that's the other thing I wanted to ask, is what's competing in this space? Is there anything that has this kind of real-time analytics that is open source or even proprietary that you would compare this with?
In the first blog post, when we announced that we released Hydra, we did sort of a lot of like history sort of things, looking because obviously hierarchical databases are not a new idea. And there's still some IBM product that I think they still sell that's marketed as like the information management system hierarchical database. So there's plenty of similar ideas that have been expressed in that space. And obviously, whether it's, we think Hydra is a very good and natural solution for this sort of nearline web processing, but obviously all sorts of successful companies have cobbled things together with Storm, Hadoop, and various databases. So I think the sort of question is there is now that we have a bunch of tools, and I think everyone has accepted that it's good to have a bunch of tools. Like, we're not just going to solve everything with MySQL or MapReduce. How can those tools best fit together? And that's something I think we'll learn more of as people with different perspectives try it out.
Cool, very cool. And I have to ask two final questions or else my audience gets mad at me. They send me emails and I forgot. So what's your favorite scripting language?
I do most of my scripting type work in Python. I've had good luck with that for quite a while now.
Cool. And your favorite text editor?
Emacs.
Yay! Got one in my score, one of my side. Yay! Very good.
Got one of
very
the oddballs good. With you there.
I know, one of the old guys, actually. Well, you're not that old, so I don't know. I'm amazed you used Emacs, which is always surprising to me, but cool.
Yeah, because all the Java guys who use various IDEs, so that's we have like two Java IDEs and Emacs we try to support, and one of them always ends up being the odd duck out. They're not always Emacs. Sometimes it's just Eclipse and IntelliJ that can't agree.
Interesting.
Cool. Well, Chris, it's been wonderful having you on the show and talking about Hydra, and I know some people now are going to go off and check this thing out. Thanks for being on the show.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
And that was Chris Burrows, who's representing the Hydra project to us. What do you think, Aaron?
I think it's just perfect timing. I mean, this space is exploding right now. So, you know, having another open source option that's maybe geared, you know, for people that want to deal with a tree structure as opposed to kind of a table structure or some other structure, I think that is perfect, right? And the timing is perfect. So, you know, I think this is going to get picked up a lot by folks and hopefully a lot of people that want to chip in and help or write, you know, translation layers or things like that. I think it's a good project that's perfectly timed with where we are right now in the data processing space. So it looks really, really interesting.
Well, I'm just thinking of it right now. I mean, for my current client, we've got four web machines generating, you know, hundreds of hits a second each. And we have some ad hoc query tools that go through and look for the average time that a query takes and how much CPU gets involved. I added a little probe into Apache to tell me the total CPU each hit takes on top of how much the real time takes. So I can even tell the percentage of whether it's beating up on the CPU or whether it's mostly waiting on the database. Mm-hmm. I always put that in as like my first tool I do everywhere I go because it's such a nice little probe to have.
Yeah.
And so being able to, you know, we've got these ad hoc tools, but it'd be nice to have something, first off, that isn't just running on one of the four machines because now I'm only getting 1/4 of the data, but also so I would have this sort of aggregation. I'm thinking war room kind of displays. You know, they already have some stuff, I think, in Graphite or something similar to that to be able to analyze this stuff because, you know, I'm here to make things go faster. And already so far I've made the 50th percentile, the average hit, is already twice as fast as it used to be, and I've only been here for 5 weeks. And the 95th percentile has actually smoothed out. It's actually much lower now. So they're liking me, but it'd be nice to have some better metrics that we could say specifically on the pages I just fixed yesterday compared to today. Are these pages responding faster and are the database queries happening faster? So I'm already seeing this. So that's why I said, well, how do we gather the data from these ongoing Apache logs in near real time? And what do we have to do to set that up to hook this up? But it sounds like Hydra could actually be the tool I might want to use.
Yeah, I was just going to say this is a perfect opportunity for someone to come up with a Perl module for Hydra. And it looks like there's actually some out there. PISG parser and it has a format Hydra. So I don't know, you know, Hydra's kind of a common name, so I don't know if that's exactly applicable to this or not, but I'm assuming that's probably what it is based on the name of the module. But yeah, someone should write a Hydra module for Perl. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, and I'm also thinking, of course, with my new Dart love, that as long as the data is available in some sort of Ajaxy REST API somewhere, I could make you know, real-time web page updates with Dart to draw graphs and things like that and implement stuff like that. So this is sounding usable even in the next hour. Like, I can go away and start researching this a little bit more and say, hey, I need to install this, be able to do the rest of my performance tuning for the rest of the year. So that would be very cool. And again, a really fresh open source project. I like that they've they've committed to this internally and externally, and I hope a community builds around it. I hope also that the word Hydra is not trademarked to something that's similar. I hope they did that search on that before they picked the name.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, thank you for your comment on that. Just yeah,
sure.
Wonderful. You don't disagree with that at all?
Not at all. Whatever you just said, I am 100% for it or against it. If that was your premise.
Yeah, well, whatever. Okay. Anything else before we move on?
That's the problem with having the chat room here. You're talking, and I'm like, ooh, that sounds like an interesting. What are they talking about over there? And then you're
stop
like,
reading
right,
the
Aaron?
Chat room. You're chatting with me.
Yes. Yes.
Here we go.
Yes, sir.
There we go. I know the chat room is so distracting. That's why we tell the guests do not go into the chat room unless you have three chats open all day and you actually know how to ignore
it's
most things that go by.
It's a black hole.
On it.
A black hole of attention.
It's tough. It's tough even for me. Even when I'm when you're actually asking the questions and I'm supposed to be watching the chat, it's tough even for me not to get distracted by that. If there's things that are non-topic related. Anyway, speaking of being distracted by upcoming things, did I say it that way? No, I guess I didn't. But that's my awkward transition for the week. We got Monogame coming up next week, which is the implementation of Microsoft XNA architecture, which I understand is no longer the architecture they use, but it is still the one that most of the game manufacturers are writing to and apparently using it in backwards compatible mode. But the best thing is that this thing then allows you to take that Microsoft XNA architecture game and port it to just about everything else, Linux, iOS, Android, and anywhere else you want to go with the thing. So I'm liking that. They're coming on next week. Hopefully I'll bring on one of the gamers. Aaron, are you a big gamer?
I am a big gamer, yeah.
Are you coming on next week now?
I don't know. I'm willing if you're willing to have me. Yeah, I've been into all kinds of games lately. I've been playing FTL, which is, oh, man, such a time sink. It's such a fun game.
Oh, you know who's into games, though, is Gamerol. So maybe I'll bring him in for that show.
Sure.
He's a big game writer, actually. He's done a lot of that stuff. So maybe that'll be a fun thing for that. And then following that, we've got Typo 3, which is apparently a successor to Typo 2 and Typo 1 because those didn't work so well. No, it's Enterprise CMS being used, I think, mostly in Europe. But we haven't had CMSs on here for a while. And for a while, it was like CMS quarter, and then it was like cloud quarter. So we're back to the CMSs. They suggested themselves to be on the show, and I liked what I saw, so they'll be coming on. GNU Health immediately after that, which is a top-to-bottom, hospital and clinic management system. So that would include everything from patient records to billing and insurance and all that sort of stuff. So looking forward to that. It's actually an award winner from the Free Software Foundation projects. Koros, which is Linux for massive server deployments. Don't know anything about it except that. That's on their front page, so we'll have to ask them what that is actually all about. Nearly scheduled. I keep saying this because I'm waiting for the email back from both of these guys. Open Blue Dragon, which, I'm sorry, last week I got it confused with some other project that I'm also trying to get on the show. Open Blue Dragon is a cold fusion engine. So for those of you that are still in the cold fusion world, this is an open source implementation of that and apparently in use quite a few places. It's still like cold fusion. Also nearly scheduled is the OpenShot video editor. I saw these guys at Scale over the weekend and again, doing some wonderful stuff with that. They're, again, on the very short list. He's probably going to come on probably mid-April. He says he's got a new release coming out, so he wants to talk about the new release. So we'll do that. Again, I'm still continuing to schedule Q2. You can go to twit.tv/floss to find out how I'm doing. If you have a project that's not on that big, massive list that's there, you can help me out by having the project leader email me, merlin@stoneinch.com, and I will get them on the short list as quickly as I can. That is how all of the guests, well, almost all the guests in the last 3 years have been scheduled. So project leader has emailed me, then I put them on the schedule. So that's how it works. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google+, where I try to post new guests as I add them, and also a reminder of the day's show as it's coming up, usually about an hour in advance. Floss Weekly on Twitter, FLOSSWEKLY, just like it sounds, all one word. We do have a live chat. As we said, we took a couple questions from there this week, and also we got distracted by the live chat this week. This is at live.twitch.tv, and we tape typically at 8:30 a.m. Pacific times. So that would be on Wednesday. Sorry, I should say the day. We're the earliest show on the Twit Network. We make our producer come in early just to be able to do this show. We appreciate that, though. It's very nice. You can follow me at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. But that's actually mostly just posting links from my Google+, which is Randall L. Schwartz. all one word. Well, plus Randall L. Schwartz, I guess. Speaking of Scale, I was at Scale over the weekend. I had a lot of fun meeting up with people I haven't seen in a while and making new friends as well, looking for a couple new Floss Weekly guests. I think I've been able to nail that. And I also spoke. I did my talk on my half-life with Pearl, and it was taped. So when I get... Oh, that's an anachronism, too. I hate that when I do that. But it was taped, you know. It was the thing, and then the screen, and then something spun around, and it was on that. So when the link to that comes out, when they finish pushing it up to the CDN, I will post that, and I'll talk about it also in Floss Weekly, but I'll post that to my Google Plus listings. Interesting enough as well, a lot of people talked about my weight loss because it was like, you know, some people hadn't seen me for a couple of years, and they were all like commenting, oh, my God, you're so skinny now. One other guy also who's been listening to me, I think, on this show and also seeing my postings on Google Plus, had lost 40 pounds since the last time I've seen him. And that was just amazingly awesome. It's not all about weight loss. It's about being healthy. But low carb, high fat is the way to go. And I'm still happy with that after a year of being in maintenance. And in fact, oh, one of the anecdotes from that, since this is my pulpit, I can say what I want, is I normally get an extra large t-shirt at a conference. This time I said, I'm not an extra large anymore. I asked for a medium t-shirt and I put it on and it fit.
Whoa.
I have not been a medium ever. Well, not since maybe high school.
Yeah.
So that was really spooky. So now all these extra large shirts that I've been collecting over the years, some of the conferences, they're all going to be swimming in them. It's
right.
Going to be too big.
Oh, man, that's awesome. I know. I'm trying to make the jump from extra large to large. And I'm kind of like, is the shirt going to shrink? Because I may still need to get an extra large.
I even put the medium shirt on over my current shirt.
Wow, that's
so
cool.
It wasn't even like it had to like crawl into it. No, it fit nicely.
That's an awesome feeling.
Oh, it was so cool. And it didn't even like pull up a little bit. It actually, you know, went below my belt and stuff. So it was the normal size for me, which is just amazing. I'm a medium now. I'm an M. I quoted that on my Google Plus. So the whole story is in there if you want to hear that. Anything you want to plug today, Aaron?
Sure. You can follow me on the Twit Network on this show and other shows, which I am an occasional co-host of. Just look for me on the Twit Network. I'm kind of all over the place. I'll be doing a review for... Before You Buy coming up pretty soon, so look for that. Also, you can follow me on Google. That's Google Plus. That's where I spend most of my time and have conversations with people and post what I'm talking about. And then it also spills over into Facebook and Twitter. So if you like those social networks, you can follow me there as well. But Google Plus is the place where I hang out, no pun intended. So if you want to follow me, definitely check out there. Also, I think I've mentioned this before, but the makerspace in my hometown of Benicia is getting going. And if you're interested, if you live in Solano County, California, or Contra Costa County, California, and you want to find a place where people like to make things and do things like I do, you can join us. You can go to meetup.com/Benicia Makerspace and find out there. We've got a workshop coming up next Monday on 3D printing. Unfortunately, that meetup is completely booked. So we had so much interest, we had to basically stop taking reservations because we ran out of space. But we'll be doing the 3D printing workshop again coming up later on, you know, sometime in the year, maybe in the summertime, we'll do another 3D printing workshop. But get involved, go check us out. And if you live locally or just want to get involved somehow or find out what's going on, definitely go to our meetup page and support us and check us out. It's a lot of fun.
Very cool, Aaron. Well, thank you once again for driving up to the Brick House to help me out with this show and probably do a few other shows while you're there. Really appreciate that.
You bet. Anytime.
All right. Very good. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.